Mr. Longhi comes to the dispatch box, and the house on both sides is rising to him. That is a very, very rare event in the Oxford Union. I'm not sure in the 25 years since I was president I've ever seen that happen here in this historic hall before. But he is having a most enthusiastic reception. Not quite everybody is on their feet, but a very large numbers. And it's on both sides of the house. It's a mark of courtesy and respect, as well as, in some cases, support for his views. Here is the Prime Minister.
Honourable members of the Union, ladies and gentlemen, in fact, if I could greet straight away, because I understand there is a direct fee to the White House tonight, if I could greet the President of the United States, who is, of course, at the very genesis of the proposition we're debating tonight. A quote in Time magazine last year, an assertion by the President of the United States that nuclear weapons were immoral. His avowal reiterated in January this year in the statement over the space initiative known as SDI. And there again, he asserted that this system of the nuclear stare-up cannot be sustained morally. May I say to the honourable gentleman that preceded me, there is nothing of what I am about to say which has been conditioned in any way by my meeting with the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom yesterday. I did not meet her yesterday. I am meeting her on Monday. But I know the apprehension that he feels at his constant fear of being summoned to that carpet. I understand. I also feel a considerable sympathy for the members of the opposite side who have this extraordinary sense of destabilization at the imminent prospect of peace breaking out. The character of their arguments, sir, is something which I find regrettable. If I could say very simply that it is my conviction that there is no moral case for nuclear weapons, that the best defense which can be made of their existence and the threat of their use is, as we have heard tonight, that they are a necessary evil, an abhorrent means to a desirable end. I hold that the character of nuclear weapons is such that their very existence corrupts the best of intentions, that the means, in fact, perverts the end. And I hold that their character is such that they have brought us to the greatest of all perversions, the belief that this evil is necessary, as it has been stated tonight, when, in fact, it is not. And I make my case against nuclear weapons the more vigorously because I distinguish between them and all other forms of coercive or deterrent power. I've got no case to make against the policeman's truncheon. And the people tonight who have argued that you must go to the ultimate in force every time you seek to embark upon it is, of course, a surrender to the worst immorality. I accept and do not wish to be heard arguing here against any proposition that the state must arm itself with military force to protect its citizens against aggression or defend the weak and the helpless against aggression. But I do not accept that the state must, for those reasons, arm itself with nuclear weapons. That is a case I do not easily or lightly make in Europe, where governments have held it their duty to arm themselves with nuclear weapons. I do not doubt for one moment the quality of the intention which led to that decision or that series of decisions. And I freely acknowledge that that decision is pursued in good conscience with the honourable intention of preserving the life and freedom of the people of Western Europe, because those governments are faced with the close presence of an alien and relentlessly oppressive regime and obviously feel it their duty to prepare for their own defence by membership in what for most governments' policy now is straightforwardly a nuclear alliance. That is an assessment I understand, and I do not come here to argue for any proposition in favour of unilateral disarmament. And if I make that acknowledgement, I must then deal with the argument that it is the intention which determines the moral character of the action. My contention is very simply that the character of nuclear weapons is such that it is demonstrably the case that they subvert the best of intentions. And the snuggling up to the nuclear arsenal, which has gone on with my friends on the opposite side tonight, show at what level of elegance, sophistication, and refinement that subversion takes place. There is, Mr. President, a quality of irrationality about nuclear weapons which does not sit well with good intentions. A system of defense serves its purpose if it guarantees the security of those it protects. A system of nuclear defense guarantees only insecurity. The means of defense terrorize as much as the threat of attack. In Europe, it is impossible to be unaware of the intensity of military preparedness. In New Zealand, the visitor must make an effort to find a military installation, or indeed any sign of military activity, although it does exist. There is no imperative in New Zealand to prepare for war. The result is that I feel safer in Wellington than I ever could in London or New York or Oxford. The fact is that Europe and the United States are ringed about with nuclear weapons, and your people have never been more at risk. There is simply only one thing more terrifying than nuclear weapons pointed in your direction, and that is nuclear weapons pointed in your enemy's direction. The outcome of their use would be the same in either case, and that is the annihilation of you and all of us. And that is a defense which is no defense. Is it a defense which disturbs far more than it reassures? The intention of those who, for honorable motives, use nuclear weapons to deter is to enhance security. Notwithstanding that intention, they succeed only in enhancing insecurity. Because the machine has perverted the motive, the President of the United States has acknowledged it, notwithstanding that my honourable friend opposite does not. And the weapon has installed mass destruction as the objective of the best intention. The weapon simply has its own relentless logic. It is inhuman. It is the logic of escalation, the logic of the arms race. Nuclear weapons make us insecure. And to compensate for our insecurity, we build and deploy more nuclear weapons. We know that we are seized by irrationality. And every now and then, some new generation technology comes in, the argument for which is that it will cause us to draw back from the nuclear precipice. And we are seeing right now another initiative under a new title. The title, of course, in dispute as much as its efficiency will be. And that, Mr. President, is the story of the whole saga of the nuclear escalation. We know, all of us, that it is totally without reason, logic, any sense at all to have the means at the disposal of two particular sets of powers to turn this world into rubble time and time again. And yet, in spite of that awareness, the world watches as two enormous machines enhance, refine their capacity to inflict destruction on each other and on all of us. Every nuclear development, whatever its strategic or tactical significance, has only one result, and that is to add to an arsenal which is already quite beyond reason. There is an argument in defense of the possession of nuclear weapons which holds that the terror created by the existence of those weapons is in itself the fulfillment of a peaceful purpose. The argument advanced here tonight, the 50 million killed over 4 years by concerted war in a conventional sense in Europe, and the argument that somehow the existence of this mutually assured destruction phenomenon has since that time preserved this planet from destruction. It is, I think, probably an example of Northern Hemisphere or European arrogance that we overlook now the 30 million people in this world who have died in wars since then, while we are apparently beset from the two superpowers by a system designed to have people stop killing each other. I believe that the fear they inspire is not a justification for their existence.
Sir, the one area of the world that you refer to that has had no casualties is that area defended by nuclear deterrence, namely Europe. Not one of those 30 million lived in Europe.
Have you considered the proposition for one moment that that war that cost those casualties might have entrenched within people the yearning for peace, the growth of democratic institutions, the accountability of political representatives, so that none wishes to wage, conventional or nuclear terms, any war? Why attribute to the presence of that awesome potential clash of firepower a stability which your politicians have been arguing they created? You can't have it both ways. Either you are having a new united Europe marching to glory and to the exclusion of certain primary production from other countries, or you've had it there simply because you had counterpoised this terrible means of destruction. I want to pass up. Yeah.
Mr. Longy, sir, if I may address you as mate, perhaps. You've been talking about the quality of rationality. Now, I've heard many reasons advanced for keeping American sailors out of ports. Usually have something to do with the honor of the women involved or the property values of the ports. What I should like to know, sir, is why you don't do the honorable and the consistent thing and pull out of the ANZUS alliance. For whether you are snuggling up to the bomb or living in the peaceful shadow of the bomb, New Zealand benefits, sir, and that's the question with which we charge you, and that's the question with which we would like an answer, sir.
And I'm going to give it to you if you hold your breath just for a moment. I can smell the uranium on it as you lean towards me. I want to pass over here the preparations which are constantly being made for the winnable or even survivable nuclear war. I would ignore those and wholeheartedly embrace the logic of the unthinkable war if it could be established that the damage which could result from the collapse of that logic would be confined to nuclear weapon states. Unfortunately and demonstrably, it would not. We in New Zealand, you know, used to be able to relax a bit, to be able to think that we would sit comfortably while the rest of the world, seared, singed, withered, we're enraptured. And the fact is that we used to have this vision of our being some kind of an antipodean Noah's Ark, which would, from within its quite isolated preserves, spawn a whole new world of realistic humankind. Now, the fact is that we know that that is not achievable. We know that if the nuclear winter comes, we freeze, we join the rest of you. And that means that there is now a total denouement as far as any argument in favor of moral purpose goes. It is a strange, dubious, and totally unaccepted moral purpose which holds the whole of the world to ransom. There's another assertion of the good moral character of nuclear weapons, which holds that they are the armor of good and against evil. The argument of the Crusaders, the people who took to arms, the evil which cannot be defeated by persuasion or example, must needs be suppressed by annihilation. The obvious difficulty here is that evil has simply declined to be subdued. Evil has not accepted annihilation. The church and its representatives have been going at it now for 2,000 years, and it persists. Every attempt to subdue it strengthens its resolve to arm itself further. And the will of the good, in weaponry terms, is corrupted by the terrible force of the weapon into the will of the evil. And all of us, wherever we are, whatever we believe, live in fear of nuclear weapons. There is a community of interest which binds us all, the common ground, which is there so that we all wish to see the elimination of nuclear weapons. President of the United States speaks in terms of the elimination of nuclear weapons. Yet nuclear weapons proliferate. The budgets for their creation expand. They, in fact, govern us. Their existence diverts attention from the fact that there are other ways of resolving the difficulties and tensions which will always abound in the world. Nuclear weapons are not needed. All the arguments which can be brought forward in support of this evil come to nothing in the fact of its ultimate irrelevance. I don't make that assertion because I have some simple South Pacific, as you put it, grand gesture answer to the question of the existence of nuclear weapons. All of you in Europe know that negotiating an end to nuclear weapons could hardly be more difficult. And then you have the hide to come here and say that New Zealand's stance is somehow threatening the strength of the West in Geneva. And then others criticize us because they say our position has not reduced by one the number of nuclear weapons in the world. You can't have it both ways. Either the West goes to Geneva girt about with the hardware it had a month ago, or it doesn't. And it does, and in that nuclear stare out, there will be a blink, I pray, and there can be a claim back. But you know, you can't wholeheartedly support the argument in favour of the superpowers negotiating control of them while nuclear powers embrace the logic of escalation.
So there are many, many of us here tonight who are very impressed by your courage and idealism. But on the other side of the house, from which I come, there are many of us... there are many of us indeed who cannot but remember that this debate is only taking place because hundreds of thousands of your fellow countrymen were prepared to give their lives so that we might live in freedom. And the accusation which those of us who would be your friends and supporters still must make against you is to express our skepticism that you are substituting idealism, a very fragile idealism, for the very secure reality that we have gained through long years of struggle. And I put that to you that that is the real subject we are debating tonight, and I would ask you to answer it.
It is the simple fact is that I make no pretense that the problem which confronted New Zealand is the same as that which confronts Western Europe. And you point out, and you have the right to point out, and I'm glad that you did, notwithstanding that you alleged that you opposed me, that people from New Zealand, a country which has never been attacked, have willingly taken up arms in Europe. They have died in African campaigns. They have their bones bleaching in deserts. They are buried in Italy. They have fought in Vietnam. We have forces right now in Sinai. We have a battalion in Singapore where the British used to be. And the fact is, we do not shrink from that responsibility. We never have, and we are not going to. The fact is that we do not choose. We do not choose to be unilateral armies. It makes absolutely no sense for a country to surround its waters or invite into its ports or country nuclear weapons when there is no balance to be achieved. The balance is there now, there are none. And we don't propose to deter enemies which do not yet exist. And I ask you to consider that as a fundamental reality of the New Zealand position. And the people of New Zealand reached a very straightforward conclusion that nuclear weapons which would defend them, they believe, cause them more alarm than any which threaten them. And accordingly, they deem it pointless to be defended by them, and the speakers for the negative who asked the question, are we prepared to have a nuclear umbrella from the United States in terms of an ANZUS arrangement? The answer to that, very simply, very definitely, is not only are we prepared to accept it, we deny it, we refuse it, and we specifically say we do not want to be defended by nuclear weapons because we, by that, avoid the risk of escalating our area into a nuclear zone. You see, in the South Pacific, it's not difficult to achieve the balance of force which you allows you with that cheerfulness to dispense with nuclear weapons.
Sir, I was just going to say, don't you feel that you should weigh your moral stance with the pernicious effects that it will have not only on Asian security, but Western security as a whole, particularly in light of the fact that there are movements in Japan, Australia, and NATO itself that would like to pull out and use your precedent as an example and pull out of their responsibilities to the alliance? And I, for one, as an American, do not feel that we should shoulder the defense of the Western world. And I think it's something that everybody should contribute to, and you, sir, are not doing your part.
Well, I tell you, this country, New Zealand, is not going to contribute to a nuclear alliance. This country, New Zealand, never has. New Zealand was declared by the former government to be no part of a nuclear alliance, and we will pick up the tab by conventional defense. And one of the immoralities of nuclear weaponry, surely, is that it creates such a level of depersonalization that the infinite capacity of destruction is unleashed by a few. Much more is there a moral posture in the conventional defense, where the humanity of the situation has to be constantly assessed, and where there is always the possibility of restraint, because individual people say, damn it, I'm not going to go ahead and do that, because it is absolutely immoral, contrary to the whole ethos of humankind to do that. You don't get the checks and balances along the nuclear trail. And in my country, we pay our tab. We are not creating a policy for imitation or export. We can't even deport it to Australia. It's 1,200 miles away. And if you think that Belgium and Holland and Greece developed a certain posture, an undercurrent, a surge because of the New Zealand position, you do us a considerable flattery about our omnipotence, because, you know, we didn't know they were even thinking about it. And we are no threat to that. I say to you, we are prepared to pay that price. We have a long history of being anti-nuclear. One of my predecessors in office sent those ships to Mururoa. We've had the fight at the legal areas. We are constantly at issue with France. We proposed in 75 a South Pacific nuclear free zone. We are going to work to perfect that this year. We have honoured our long-standing commitments. We've not welched on any deal for defence. We are in Singapore with a battalion where Britain was, and we are going to see that we contribute to regional security and stability. And what has happened to New Zealand since the Labour government was elected last year and began to implement its long-established policy? And you know, one of the amazing things about expectations of world governments is that first they assume that an opposition's policy is infinitely flexible, and then they immediately assume that when you get into government, you'll do a U-turn. Well, we are not infinitely flexible, and we've done no U-turn, and we've done exactly what we said we would do. And that, of course, is terribly destabilizing, because it makes it so difficult to read all the signs. But what essentially has happened is a demonstration of how nuclear weapons have assumed a moral life of their own. We've never been part of a strategic nuclear defense. The only nuclear weapons which presumably were bought by our ally to New Zealand in the past have been tactical weapons. We decided we didn't want to be part of someone's tactical nuclear battle. It's just about as being bad as being part of someone's strategic nuclear battle. But that has not in any way diminished the deterrent power of the Western alliance. We have not given comfort to the Soviet bloc. We have not undermined the West. But the result has been that we have been told by some officials in the United States administration that our decision is not, as they put it, to be cost-free, that we are, in fact, to be made to pay for our action, not by our enemies, but by our friends. We are, in fact, to be made an example of. We are to be ostracized. We are to be convicted of some form of heresy and put on probation. We are going to be kept there until we are compelled to resume our seat in the dress circle of the nuclear theatre. We have been told that because others in the West, and their advocates are here tonight, carry the fearful burden of an offence which terrorises as much as the threat it counters, we too must carry that burden. We are actually told that New Zealanders cannot decide for themselves how to defend New Zealand, but are obliged to adopt the methods which others use to defend themselves. Lord Carrington made a case in Copenhagen recently against the creation of nuclear weapon-free zones. He argued that if the people of the United States, as advocated by my friend over there, found themselves bearing the burden alone, they would tire of bearing it. Now, that is exactly the point. Genuine agreement about the control of nuclear weapons do not cede the advantage to one side or the other. They enhance security. They do not diminish it. And if such arrangements can be made and such agreements reached, then those who remain outside those arrangements might well and truly tire of their insecurity. They will reject the logic of the weapon, and they will assert their essential humanity. They will look for arms control agreements which are real and verifiable. And there's no humanity at all in the logic which holds that my country, New Zealand, must be obliged to play host to nuclear weapons because others in the West are playing host to nuclear weapons. That is the logic which refuses to admit that there is any alternative to nuclear weapons when plainly there is. It is self-defeating logic, just as the weapons themselves are self-defeating. To compel an ally to accept nuclear weapons against the wishes of that ally is to take the moral position of totalitarianism, which allows for no self-determination, and which is exactly the evil that we're supposed to be fighting against. Any claim to a moral justification for the West's possession of nuclear weapons is thereby eliminated. In those circumstances, we would be no better than they are. The great strength of the West, in fact, lies not in the force of arms, although some would seek, under the cover of a benign democracy, to argue that it is, in fact, the force of arms. But it lies in its free and democratic systems of government. And that's why, despite all the difficulties, the disagreement which we have amongst friends and allies, I'm not disheartened. I came to Great Britain by way of the United States, where I put my case to the American people through the news media without any kind of hindrance at all from the United States administration. Members of Her Majesty's government have made it plain to me that they do not hold with the views I am committed to. I, in fact, have heard those before. The other night I heard them from Washington. They were compelling. They were a restatement of the United Kingdom position, and they were said with such candor and frankness that they seemed to persist. Even after the volume had been turned off, they were done with a strength and a purpose and a vigor. I would say that notwithstanding that difference, I have felt welcome here. I have been freely able to express my views. I can say freely whatever I please, just as any member of Her Majesty's government in the United Kingdom would be welcome in New Zealand to expound any kind of argument in any forum she cared to use. That is the true strength of the West. And that is a strength which is threatened, not defended by nuclear weapons. The appalling character of those weapons has robbed us of our right to determine our destiny and subordinates our humanity to their manic logic. They have subordinated reason to irrationality and placed our very will to live in hostage. Rejecting the logic of nuclear weapons does not mean surrendering to evil. Evil must still be guarded against. Rejecting nuclear weapons is to assert what is human over the evil nature of the weapon. It is to restore to humanity the power of decision. It is to allow a moral force to reign supreme. It stops the macho lurch into mutual madness. And for me, the position of my country is a genuine long-term affirmation of this proposition that nuclear weapons are morally indefensible, and I support that proposition.
A standing ovation from here in the Oxford Union for the Prime Minister of New Zealand, Mr. David Longie.